And the two of us always got blamed for eating buns. My mum would bake buns and things at the end of the week, maybe, and then the buns would suddenly go down in numbers. So Brenton and I were always the ones who got blamed for having eaten the buns.
When he was disappeared, he was expecting the baby, and, you know, things, new job, things were good for him at that stage. You missed that part of developing a relationship with your brother.
We found him on the 1st of October last year, 2014. Through it all, and at the funeral and all, like, you know, it was great seeing all their elders. I think I was missing with my mother. I'm sure it was a thing that, in the end, probably, you know, she died of a brain hemorrhage, and she was always worried about him and thinking about him.
At one level, you're recovering somebody who's been missing for 30 or 40 years in some cases. But at another level, it's a human being who was presumably taken out onto that bog and murdered. The majority of the victims are only youngsters, are taken out presumably late at night, who knows. They're taken onto a bog, they stand in front of a hole and somebody shoots them. It's horrendous.
He was one of life's characters, and unfortunately there's not as many of them about now. But anybody that knew him will never forget him.
In October 2014, the remains of 22-year-old Brendan McGraw were located in Orristown Bog in County Meath, bringing to an end a long and painful search by his family, which lasted 36 years. On the 8th of April 1978, Brendan was abducted from his home in West Belfast, never to be seen alive again. This is the story of Brendan's life and subsequent abduction, and the impact it had on his family, recounted in their own words.
Sean McGraw, brother of Brendan. Okay, well, we're standing here on the bridge. This bridge used to be called the Metal Bridge, but that's gone now. And we're looking down the railway line over towards where we used to live. It was an old farmhouse, two stories. No running water, no electricity, no telephone. He had to pump the water in. And my grandfather had a farm about 30 acres. And it fields either side of the railway line. Cattle, he had a horse, hens. He tried ducks for a while, but the fox got to him one night, so he abandoned the ducks. When we were in our teens and that and younger, we used to help with the hay. That was a big job every summer, getting the hay into ricks and things like that. Yeah, Brendan was only living here for a few months. But over the years then, like, we would have come out regularly with our parents. He would have come out sometimes on his own on the bus to stay with my grandparents. And my grandfather would maybe kill a chicken now and again, and he could have a nice dinner totally produced on the farm, like with the vegetables and the potatoes. So a lot of good memories about it out here. And we had neighbours, Mulhollands, who we knew, and Brian had a donkey, and they'd come over with that sometimes. So it was happy memories of it. And then we had moved to Belfast, but like, we'd come out here. I come out regularly. I would cycle them sometimes, about 13 miles, 14 miles from Belfast, over the mountain.
I'm Deirdre Carnegie, and Brendan McGraw's sister. When he was the youngest that I can remember, really, was we lived down in Oranvara in Belfast, and we had a wooden floor in the hallway. And to amuse ourselves, sometimes he would probably been 3 or 4, and I was, you know, 5 years older. We slid up and down, played sliding on the hall floor, which was great fun. It probably helped Mum as well, because we polished the floor for her at the same time, doing it in our socks or on a piece of cloth or something. So that was good fun. He always liked to have a bike, so he probably had a bike from him. He could ride a two-wheeler bicycle, and he was always out on his bike. He liked listening to music. Procol Harum was his favourite sort of thing in later times. And our main thing was the two of us in the middle. Sean was the oldest, and then it was me, then Brenton, and Kieran was the little one. So the two of us always got blamed for eating buns. My mum would bake buns and things at the end of the week maybe, and then the buns would suddenly go down in numbers. So Brenton and I were always the ones who got blamed for having eaten the buns. One memory definitely I have is that when our dad died, I was 13, Brenton was 8. A neighbour kindly offered that Brenton could go and stay down at her house. She only lived a few doors from us. She had a few boys, so Brenton would have played with them anyhow. So he went down to stay there. And afterwards, when she was talking to Mummy after, she said that she was totally amazed how neatly he folded all his clothes when he took them off at night to go to bed. He took each item off, folded it and put it on the chair, ready to be put back on the next morning. And she sort of said, I wish my boys could do put their clothes as tidy as that.
My name's Tony McGraw and I'm Brendan's first cousin. I would have been 7 whenever we came from England. That was in 1969. Brendan and Kieran were both the people that we would have had contact with that were relatives whenever we came to the country first. And because Brendan was older than me, he was my big cousin that I looked up to. We would have gone over to my Auntie Bridie's to visit probably once every month. And it was a big occasion, big trip over. See my Aunt Bridie, who's a lovely woman, and obviously the cousins get out and have a bit of an adventure in a new place in town.
My name is Kieran McGraw, and I'm Brendan's younger brother. Different things with my dad. I can remember him sort of serving on the altar, and, you know, I was down at Clonard's because he had went to primary school in St Finian's, which is on down the Falls Road. So, I mean, he always seemed to enjoy that sort of side of things. At other times he'd be, you know, trying to get me to get the shoes polished and whatever, where if I was out kicking the football, then obviously that was having an effect on the shoes. Like, so different things they got, you know. Like, he Ben Sherman shirts and Oxfords and the jeans. I probably wasn't at that stage of just wearing them, but, you know, he was sort of very fashion conscious, so you wouldn't have touched them, like. I showed you a picture earlier on at the right and the back right, and he's sitting in the centre and sort of having a bit of, you know, crack or whatever. So he would initially be quiet within the group, but as they got to know him, he seemed to get on well. And, you know, as I was growing up, at times, oh, you Brendan McGraw's wee brother, or you look very alike. The night that Brendan's body were having the wake at the house, at my home as such, one of his friends that came in was telling the story about when he lived at home in my mum's house, somebody was looking at a light for the cigarette, and the electric fire was on, 3-bar electric fire, and then no matches or a lighter, so they decided to get down and light the cigarette at the fire. So Brendan came back in the room, he'd noticed the mark on the electric bar, and, you know, started saying, my mum's going to crack up type of thing, like, so I'm going to have to get that cleaned. So there was a companion set sitting beside the fire, and he lifted the poker and started to scratch it, but obviously hadn't turned the fire off at that stage. So there was an almighty bang, and he was through back against the settee and the wall, and, you know, the fire stopped working, plus all the guys were, you know, laughing their heads off. Like, but so I suppose maybe, what was it, 30-odd years I found out what was the reason for the electric fire not working anymore, like. Because at that stage, you know, I was a younger brother, and you wouldn't have been allowed in the room. You just heard a sort of bang, but that sort of solved that problem anyway. At different times, we would have went maybe to the swimming pool. And one time, I remember, we went to the Grove Baths in the sort of North Belfast, and we got back to our change room, and the bus money was gone. So I don't know how I managed, but I got talking to the manager, and got to lend the money to get us the bus. We had to get a bus in the town and then bus back up the Falls Road. We had slightly different interests. He was into motorbikes and bikes, whereas I was more enjoyed sort of hurling or sport and such. So you would have had this discussion, you know, if you're looking to get the TV turned over, and you'd be saying, no, we're watching the Grand Prix, and you're saying, so that's where the cars going round or bikes round the circle, and then he'd be arguing back the football, only kicking a wee ball.
Well, we're sitting in Knowanvara Park. We moved here in 1955 from Glenavy, and we were really looking forward to it because this place was going to have electricity, running water, and a bath, which, you know, we didn't have in Glenavy. So not that long after Brenton was born, I'd say probably, like, he was still in his early months, and we moved here to Owenborough Park. I was closer to work for Dad. He worked about 3 miles away in the Woodburn Hotel with Casement Park beside us. I used to love going up to the matches and things like that, and there's more people coming to visit us and stuff like that. It was really good. Brenton liked it because he had great fun. I remember one day Mam had him out in the front garden in his playpen, and Brenton started his early career of recklessness on the road. He pushed the playpen out of the garden, got the front gate open. Now, he's only about two. Got the front gate open and pushed the playpen out onto the road, forcing a passing motorist to stop, who came in and alerted us to the fact that Brent was out on the road. Of course, my mother near died. We all near died. Shock. See the playpen out in the middle of the road. So that was Brenton's first experience out on the road at the age of two. When we got to the age of five, that was about 1960, he started going to school. He went to St Finian's School, that's down the Falls Road. He liked school then. It was Brothers, De La Salle Brothers School. Well, I'm standing here now looking across at the porch in the house, and like, it was a covered in porch. And she had a pram, I think it was one of them pedigree prams they were in those days. And it was the thing then that the child had to get plenty of fresh air. And I remember Brenton being parked outside in the pram, well wrapped up, but he had to have his hour or two out in the fresh air to keep him healthy. When we then left here, that was about 1962, Brenton was about 7 years old. He was still at school, obviously. But we moved up closer to where Dad worked. We moved up to Stewartstown Avenue, which was only less than half a mile from the Woodburn House Hotel. 1962, we moved up here to Stewartstown Avenue. It was a brand new house, a new development, with great view from here out across the city. But I wasn't that keen on moving up here. We preferred to stay down in Owenborough. It was closer to Casement Park and things like that, and people I knew. It was closer for Dad to work, so like, he could drop home very quick. There was no traffic problems. He'd drive out of work and he'd be here in 2 minutes. So for him that was important, because he worked long hours being a chef. Now, we'd only been here just over a year. I had started work and I'd left school. I remember one morning I got a message in work. Mom was on the phone and she said that my dad, she didn't think he was too... I think the words she said, I think he's dead. So I come home, Dad was dead. It was a terrible tragedy for all of us. But Brenton in particular, he was only, 8 at the time, this 1963, August 1963. And for him it was a big emotional thing. For a long time after, he was, today they'd probably say behaviour problems, but it really upset him, the fact that he had lost his dad. And of course, Mom got upset because of that. And hard times for us as well, because my dad had died and there was no wage coming into the house. Mom applied for the widow's pension, which wasn't very much. And we had a car out in the garage that had to be sold, and still a mortgage to be paid. So we all had to work a bit harder. I took another part-time job in the evening, the Woodburn Hotel, where Dad had worked. They offered me nights and things like that. 1967 then, Brenton started going to secondary school, the De La Salle College down in here in Andersonstown. He got on fairly well, but Brenton wasn't that keen on school, I think, at that age at all. He liked doing the metalwork. He really loved anything creative with his hands, he could do it. But the other business of learning wasn't his scene. He finished up in school when he was 15. That was about 1970. I think Mam, with her contacts, managed to get him a job as an apprentice chef or something in the kitchens in the Grand Central Hotel. My dad had worked there back in the 40s. But Brenton wasn't cut out to be a chef. He'd got all the gear, the white coats and the trousers and the hat and all that stuff, but wasted. He didn't last very long. But it was a very troubled time in Belfast. In fact, I remember the day that internment was introduced, there was no buses in the Falls Road. Brenton got the bus up the Lisburn Road. I got the train up the Balmoral Station. And both of us had walked up Stockman's Lane. And we bumped into one another near the Anderson's Town Road. We were going to go over and check on our grandmother, who lived in South Link, it was there, an apartment, or flats as we call them in Belfast. And just as we were about to cross the road, there was shooting started, and Brenton and me had to lie down in the gutter up against the curb for protection. It was a frightening experience at the time, but when looking back on it, I mean, there'd been so many shooting incidents around that time that it wasn't unusual. But we stayed there until it was safe to get up, and then we went over to check on my granny. She was okay. She was hard of hearing, which was probably an advantage in those days because you didn't hear half the shooting or the bombs. So she wasn't the least perturbed about what was going on.
Brendan and I were both in the motorcycles, and we spent a bit of time, let's say, travelling around the country, country lanes on our motorcycles. We would also have met in town and did what normal young men do in town. And we were quite fond of doing a bit of squash, and Maysfield Leisure Centre was the main place for us for that. And we spent many, many times down there playing squash, having a bit of a sauna and what have you afterwards. And I wouldn't say squash was a huge part of his life. It was something that we did because it was something different and we were trying to broaden our horizons and stay a little bit fitter than what we maybe were. There'd been four of us down. We'd had the usual game and retired in, had a glass of orange up in the canteen. And I suppose still 20 minutes later, Brendan hadn't emerged from the changing rooms. He was still down there grooming himself and making sure every hair was in place and his shoes were still shined. Unlike me, I was very through all. He was meticulous in what he did, to the point that sometimes he'd even iron in a crease into his jeans, which was a bit strange at the time. His shoes were mirrors all the time, polished to perfection. Hair, if you found a hair to place on his head, you would have been looking very closely. Well, I was doing a welding course in the training centre and Brendan was doing an engineering course. So we met very regularly through the day, and whenever we needed bits and pieces done for our motorcycles, we would rely on each other to do them. I needed a set of rear sets done for my motorcycle. He needed a bit of welding done for handlebars on his. So those are the sort of things that we were able to help each other out with.
About 1975, I think Brenton went down looking for work, or probably somebody had told him there was work available down in Limerick. He went down there, he was working in a factory. I'm not sure, I can't remember what type of factory, but he was getting good work there, and he wrote home one time to Mam. He said he'd been going in an hour early every morning, he was getting double time for that, and he also asked her to post down his motorbike helmet, because he had bought a new one off some fella, and he had paid him £5, but part of the bargain was that he was to give this fella his old helmet. Now, how Mam would have managed to post a motorbike helmet, I don't know. He just asked her to do it. That was the Brenton. I mean, it was straightforward to him. Brenton stayed in Limerick, I think, for about a year. I reckon he came back about 1976. And a short time after that, he met Marie. Around 1976, In 1977, Brenton got married to Marie. The wedding took place in St. Matthias' Chapel on the Glen Road. Big lot of family and friends there. But unfortunately, the one person missing was Brenton's dad. His Uncle Matt was there. He was really happy then. I remember him going off in the car. I think they went to Dublin for their honeymoon. Yeah, pretty sure it was Dublin they went for the honeymoon. And he looked really happy going off. And then the following year, Marie was pregnant. Everybody was looking forward to having the daughter. Brenton, unfortunately, he lost his job in the carpet factory. He got a position in a training course, but didn't pay much money. So I knew the chief engineer on the ship, and he was looking for a replacement for his motorman. So he gave Brenton a week's trial, went down to Warren Point. Brenton joined the boat. Then because of a strike in Belfast, the boat came back to Greenore. I picked Brenton up that day and drove him home. We stopped in the pub in O'Meath on the way home and had a pint. That was the last time I remember having a drink with Brenton. That was around, I think, about the end of March. Can't remember exactly, but that was 1978. And that was might have been the last time I seen him. Certainly was the last time I had a drink with him. And he was really happy, and this week's trip had gone well. And later that week, I spoke to the chief engineer, and he said he was going to give Brenton the job, which was great news, because the job would have paid well. Okay, he'd have been away from home for a while, but it was good money. And it would have stood to him like if we went for other jobs. And unfortunately then, the 8th of April arrived, and Brenton went from us.
At the minute we're sitting outside the flat where Brenton was taken on the 8th of April 1978, and it's strange, you know, it's the first time I've been back here since he's actually been found and brought back to Belfast. At different times you would have come up, and it was sort of, well, it still is painful memories, but you're aware now we have got his body back. When Brenton had left early that morning to go and meet Mum in town, and Marie was in the flat, and she had heard the knock at the door, and she actually thought it was Brenton coming back, you know, maybe forgot something. But when she answered the door, then eight or nine men had come in, and they asked her a couple of questions, and then they drugged her, give an injection, and that sort of made her drowsy or whatever. And they put her in the bedroom, and then, you know, it's just they waited on Brenton coming back. When he had been in town, he'd got the radio with my mum, and then he had decided to leave her in town and then come back up home to Trimbrook.
Brenton then came home, and he walked through the door. He was sat upon by these, I think it was up to nine men were in the apartment. And they took him away. My wife Kay had gone over to Brenton's apartment to meet Marie, that's Brenton's wife. Kay had her sister Margaret with her. They went over to his house in Twinbrook. And Kay came back much earlier than I expected. And she broke the news to me that somebody had come to Brenton's apartment and taken him away. It took me a while to take it in and what she meant. I started asking her loads of questions. So anyhow, I drove over, picked up Kieran, and went on over to Brenton's. And there I met Marie, and I met Marie's mammy and stuff like that, and learnt that these men had come to the house while Brenton was out. He'd gone into town with his mother to buy a radio. And when he came home, these guys who had tied up Marie took Brenton away. As Brenton left the house, he said, "Don't worry, I'll be back. I haven't done anything." And Marie said, like, will he be back? And they told her that he'd be back, but he never came back. Now, Marie had been injected, and Marie was pregnant. She was about 3 months pregnant. And they had warned Marie not to contact the police. So we didn't know what to do. Marie was pregnant, she'd been injected, we didn't know what with. What should we do? We waited for an hour or two, and then we decided, look, we're going to have to get a doctor. The doctor came and we discussed things with him, and he said, really, she would need to go to the hospital to be checked out for take tests and things like that, because he couldn't tell what had happened to her. So Marie was taken off to the hospital, and I then went down to Dunmurry Police Station to report that Brendan had been taken away, abducted. I didn't get a great reception in the police station, but after a while they calmed down and I told them exactly what had happened. So there was a follow-up, but it never yielded any results. Mom did radio and television appeals. Newspaper carried the story from, and Marie did reports, did appeals on television, newspaper interviews. I went and spoke to people I thought might know something. All came to no avail. Nobody seemed to know anything, as if he had just disappeared from the earth.
I was meant to meet Brendan at 4 o'clock at the Boucher Road, with a view to staying with him. It was meant to be the weekend, but obviously Brendan was heading off the following day, so he didn't turn up for obvious reasons now. I had just finished work and was standing there waiting for him. He never showed up. So I walked up the road to his mother's house, and that's when I was given the news that he had been abducted. He was one of life's characters, and unfortunately, there's not as many of them about now, but anybody that knew him will never forget him.
I was living over in England, and I was told that he had been taken from his flat. He was taken on the Saturday. I received a phone call on the Monday following that from my older brother Sean's wife, Kay. She phoned to tell me, because it was going to be on the national news on the television. So that was obviously a shock, but at the time it was obviously a total mystery as well, because we didn't know who had taken him or why.
After the initial time that he was taken, she'd done an appeal on TV, she'd travelled down to Dublin, she'd travelled to Limerick, you know, different places, and just asked about, and did anybody know anything or whatever. And I think many of the mothers did do that, and went to different places and sort of tried to find out any information. So I would say many of the mothers of the ones that were disappeared had went to various places to see if they could find out. No, I suppose maybe after a couple of months, maybe I think one of the bikes were there, and she'd maybe got that one of the friends to maybe look after it and type of thing. But I suppose it was always difficult because he was so particular about the bike. You know, he would have, if the bike was in the garage, you say don't touch it, or so she obviously wouldn't. But you know, at times then she felt she was sort of, you know, caught in between. I think that was probably one of the traumatic things for her. Like if I get rid of this, that's a memory gone. For her as such, like, and you know, and he had his own room and stuff, so she would have maybe packed up some of the clothes, but. The clothes and that, and she kept a lot of mementos, you know, maybe cards that he'd sent her at Christmas or Mother's Day, and she would have, you know, kept them in it sort of neatly in a couple of boxes and that. And, you know, all that sometimes gets lost in the story, that the anguish and the pain that the parents had went through. You know, like if you lose a child in the supermarket for a couple of minutes, you're panicking, like, so. This was a thing that never left them. Like, well, so probably the initial part, or first couple of years, he didn't actually know that he was dead. You know, there was different stories going about he was seen in Canada, America, Australia, England, wherever it may be. But there was never any substance to that. Like, And you sort of, you always hoped that he would come back. But I said before, Brenton was very attached to him. Well, many times he was away before, he always would have either phoned or, you know, sent a letter. So I suppose that part of it was, you know, surprising. And, you know, it's probably, you're saying years, but, you know, days and months had ran on, and you're always hoping that he would come back. But after a period of time, you know, that was 78, you know, maybe 5-6 years, you were thinking, he's not going to, you know, he mustn't be coming back. But he didn't necessarily think he was dead. I don't know if that sounds strange, but you're sort of wondering, he's somewhere else. But as it transpired, he wasn't somewhere else. He was actually dead. So with mid-90s and whatever, different the wave group or the families that disappeared had met up, and Mum had went to some of those meetings, and they had masses, and they were starting to raise publicity as such about the case, and they were finding there's other people in the same scenario as such. And then April 1999, we got word that the IRA had taken Brenton, had killed him, disappeared him, and that his name would be on a list that would be released, and we would find out where the body was. So obviously that was a major shock, that they'd come out and said they had killed him, whereas before, when questions were asked, nobody had knew anything about it. You know, we tried all round the different groups or whatever. Police knew nothing about it, couldn't give any information. So that was 1999. We thought it would just be a matter of weeks to find his body. We were told it was in Norristown in County Meath, so near Kells. So we knew where Kells and Alphen was, but didn't know where Norristown was. It was a surprise that he was sort of down south as such, and the same case for most of the disappeared. So we took Mum down to the site, and again, that was very traumatic for her. And we were showing where he was supposed to be buried, but it turned out, you know, after the first dig, it was unsuccessful. There was another dig the following year, and again, that was unsuccessful. So the waiting in between, waiting for the phone call, sort of was a very difficult period for everybody. Because if the phone rang, you were thinking, oh, maybe somebody's found. And then if the digs were unsuccessful, you know, your hopes were diced.
Mum died in 2002, and it was 1999 before we knew for definite. She found out that Brenton had been killed. That's when he was on the list of those who had been disappeared. So from April 1999 until January 2002, which is almost 4 years, she was praying and hoping that he would be found. I mean, she'd been down at Orristown and seen the digs finished and no sign of him. So it was very sad for her. Like, I can imagine now, like, if I lost one of my sons, what it'd be like. So it must have been terrible, like, especially losing her husband, Dan, two children who died, like, when they're very young. Gerald was about 3 months, and Joseph, I think, was about a week. So it was a tough time for her.
I mean, it was very difficult for Marie at the time. She was expecting, the baby was due in October, and, you know, she was dealing with the loss, sudden loss of her husband, didn't know where he was coming back or, you know, what was happening. And so it's probably always the uncertainty that she had to deal with. It was very difficult. And then hopefully, we were hoping then that the baby wouldn't be affected, so thankfully that didn't happen, and she was born healthy. So, you know, she had, you know, an awful lot to deal with over the years, yeah. And, you know, sort of every time it probably come back up in the news, it would have brought a lot of that back for her. you know, it was a big loss. And then at Christmas time, or, you know, different family events were going on, you were sort of thinking, well, what if he was here, or, you know, and would he have had any more children and all that type of stuff. So my mum sort of, she would have worked hard, I don't know if that's the right term, but, you know, tried her best, maybe is the term, you know, to try and keep everything as normal as possible for what was happening to the rest of us and what was happening in the rest of our lives. But, you know, inside she was going through a lot of trauma and pain. Like. So for a long period of time after that, there wasn't really, after some of the disappeared were found, there wasn't really much happening. And then the commission had met with the families, and the families were trying to get something more done. And Jeff Nuffler was appointed, and I think it was 2006. And so we were concerned that the information from previous digs would be lost, so there was no central place for somebody to go, and if information did come back, where would you go to find out where had been dug or what sort of records existed. So that was one of the things we wanted to get in place, and we started to meet other politicians and different governments and that, so we tried to push the thing forward. So after a couple of years, some more of the bodies were found. There was another dig for Brenton again. It was unsuccessful, which was very disappointing. You know, at one stage you were thinking, would we ever get him back?
This is LMFM.
Good afternoon, I'm Michael Carlin. Human remains have been found at Orrestown Bog near Kells, at the site where searches have been carried out for the body of Brendan McGraw. The discovery was made when contractors working for the Independent Commission for the Location of Victims' Remains were clearing a drain at the site in preparation for further work.
The recovery. And then, on the 1st of October 2014, we got the call they'd been found. It was just, we weren't really expecting the call just on that day. It was just unbelievable to think that they'd actually, after all this time, they had found him. And he was in between sort of where the second and third dig had been. But it was great to get him, you know, back, go and get him back up to Belfast.
My name is Jeff Nutfer. I'm the head of the investigation team for the Independent Commission for the Location of Victims' Remains. I was invited over in 2005 by the Commission and the two governments to review what the Commission had done prior to that date, since its establishment after as part of the Good Friday Agreement. My role now is as lead scientist for the Commission, but also head of the investigation team. So I've got a team of investigators who do all the background research and work, and then obviously we have a group of archaeologists and other experts who carry out the searching, physical searching. I prepared a report for the governments and the Commission in 2005. That was presented to them all in 2006. And shortly after that, I met all the families at one point or another. And, you know, they're all tragic cases. They're all terribly sad cases. But particularly struck, I can always remember meeting the two McGraw boys who I met first and foremost, Kieran and Sean. They have always been understanding, thoughtful. They've never made demands upon me or the Commission more generally. They've just been tremendous and stoical. You know, they are very kind, very considerate, and understanding, really, of the pressures and the difficulties that we have to encounter in the course of the job we do. Well, I think for everybody, it's elation tinged with terrible sadness. You know, at one level, you're recovering somebody who's been missing for 30 or 40 years in some cases. But at another level, it's a human being who was presumably taken out onto that bog and murdered. And that is a terrible, terrible thing to do. You know, you think that poor lad has been there. The majority of the victims are only youngsters. Are taken out, presumably late at night, who knows. And, you know, they're taken onto a bog, they're standing in front of a hole and somebody shoots them. It's horrendous, it really is. So this sadness at one level, but absolutely, you know, elation at having achieved what we set out to do, and months, even years of work gone into recovering Brendan, and we found him. We try not to get emotionally involved because it doesn't help, actually, but inevitably you do. And when you meet the family, and particularly with Brendan, because, you know, if you look at photographs of him, he's absolutely a spitting image of his brothers. They are very, very, you know, their facial features are very similar. And you can only just imagine that he was probably as charming a guy as they are. And it's awful. It's terribly, terribly sad. And, you know, for somebody to leave the house or to be taken from the house as he was, taken from the home and just disappear off the face of the earth, is just absolutely horrendous. It really is. It's appalling. And, you know, your heart goes out to them, really. And of course, his mum and dad who weren't here to see him brought home. We're not remotely interested in who killed the individual. We are concerned wholly and solely with identifying that individual. The state pathologist wants to know how somebody was killed. So we're all doing slightly different things, but none of us are looking to who killed that person, because our legal remit, the law, prohibits us from doing that. We're just there wholly and solely to recover, repatriate, and obviously identify. I would ask anybody who has any information, whatever, any thoughts on it, please, please do contact the Commission. Whatever you have, it could be just the last little piece of the jigsaw. So please don't think, oh, well, it's only trivial, it's rubbish. Please let us be the judges of that. The other really important factor here is that the legislation under which the Commission operates is dual legislation. So it operates both in Ireland and Northern Ireland and the UK. And that prevents us from passing that information on to anybody else, any government agency. It can only be used wholly and solely for the recovery and repatriation of the disappeared.
A recollection I have is that when I was at secondary school, I was very lucky to have as our English literature teacher, a certain Mr. Seamus Heaney. And even at that stage, he was very interested in poetry and stuff like that. And remember that he was very good even then with words, like he'd be describing things like digging, and he'd talk about people clearing shucks, and he'd describe the sound of a spade coming out of wet ground, and big bogs and things like that. And when we discovered that Brenton was buried in Norristown, I just thought of him, and like I'd see him on television, I'd always thought I'd love to get a chance to talk to him and maybe he'd give us a poem or something like that we could associate with Brenton. But it's just funny, like, those words he used about the bog and digging, like, became so relevant later on in my life. Standing here at the spot where Brenton was found, it's an Norristown bog, and I just noticed now, this is the first time I've been here since he was found, and the spot is marked by two large stones, one on top of the other, and the four trees around the site as well, and stones around it. It's a nice reminder, but a reminder of very sad event when Brenton was shot here. But then we found him on the 1st of October last year, 2014. It was a very ordinary day for me. I was just getting up, getting ready, and prepared to go out for a bit of a walk, and the phone rang, and it was Sean Hill. I think he said, "I've a bit of good news for you." And I thought he was ringing to say that, you know, they started the dig, because they've been doing a lot of prep work. I don't think the actual main part of the dig had started. So when he said good news for you, and he asked, "Is anybody with me there?" So I said, "Yeah." And when he started to say that, I thought he's going to tell me something. And he said, "We found your brother." And I couldn't answer for a while. So it was good news, but it was still a shock. Still a shock. Never thought that we'd get that. That phone call, someone you've been thinking about, and what will I do, and what will I say, and all that, but don't think I said very much. But through it all, and at the funeral and all, like, you know, it was great seeing all their elders. The thing I was missing was my mother. I'm sure it was a thing that, in the end, probably, you know, she died of a brain hemorrhage, and she was always worried about him, and thinking about him. She'd been here, yeah, a few occasions, and she was here the first time she came here. My stepfather was with her. He was very ill then. He had cancer, and I think he died that same year. But she came back a couple of occasions with my sister, and also I was here the very last time she was here. I think it was about 2001. I was here with her, and Kay, myself, Angela from Wave, a local priest, and I think the superintendent from the guards in Navan was there. Said a few prayers, but it was very sad, it was very gloomy. You know, the search had stopped and we felt they weren't going to do any more. So there wasn't much hope, there wasn't much hope at that stage. And at the time my mum died, like, there was nothing really in the air about it at all. Like, she'd got a support from people, and, you know, even the time I brought her down to Dublin and we met John Wilson and the commission up on Stephen's Green, like, it was great for her because she felt that was the first time somebody was actually listening to her. Another big occasion before that was when she'd met President Clinton in Belfast. We met several of the relatives that disappeared, and nice meeting him. It was 36 years that it was a Tuesday that he was found. It was time we got down here, it was the afternoon, and then we're waiting on my sister and my brother coming down, so it was late in the evening, and they had decided not to take Brenton away, to do some other work and, you know, check the site over and stuff like that. So it was Tuesday, Wednesday morning before he was taken away. And so he lay overnight here, but as we left, there was just one light, and that was, I think it's the old lighthouse from up near Kells. So it was the only light you could see. It was a very lonely spot. You can imagine all them years down here. Really, from once Brenton was up and out of the ground, and they took him off the next day to the morgue in Dublin, like, we followed behind for beyond Navan, and guard escort, motorbike and that, which would have suited Brenton down the ground. And after that then we were just waiting for word, but we were pretty sure it was Brenton. Once we got the DNA confirmed, took about 6 or 7 weeks, but that was okay. We felt confident.
We went down on the 1st of October. I waited to Derby come over from England, and then we headed down. And we got the site just before sort of twilight as such. But as we were standing sort of saying prayers, and you had a look around, I mean, there was no light. And you're sort of thinking, well, that's, you know, maybe that was his last recollection. He was obviously, we would have been disorientated, didn't know where he was, and thinking that he would never get home. You know, that was one of the things that drove you on, that you wanted to, you know, get his body and get him back home. And so that he wouldn't be forgotten and such. You know, if we hadn't got his body back, and you're always going down to the site and saying, well, he's here somewhere, and it meant that when you left out, there was always the frustration that you knew he wasn't coming with you. So all of that is now gone, and that, you know, that's why it's a massive, that you're hoping and praying that we can get the rest of the bodies. Since we found his body, you can, you know, there's a sort of a realisation or calmness or freedom that you know that, okay, we've got his body back. And, you know, that is a massive thing. The difference is really unbelievable to think that he's not lying in a bog. He's now, you know, he's in the grave with his mum and dad and his brothers, and he's at peace, and, you know, has peace for us as well. So you're looking for that for the other families that disappeared. And because, you know, there's always a lot of questions, the why and wherefore of why he was taken. But the target for us was to, you know, sort of get him back home. And the day, like, what was it, the 12th of November, we went to Dublin to, you know, be able to bring his body back into Belfast. That was tremendous. It's just unreal. It's still, you know, emotional. But as you come close to Belfast, it was just thinking, well, we finally got him home. And then you come back up into Stewartstown, you pass that on the way up. And then we had the wake and that for him. Because, like, when they were disappeared, it was just, everything just stopped to a certain extent. Obviously, your own life and that had continued on, but that part of your life had just stopped. And you're sort of hoping then that that can, if somebody listens to this radio program, that somebody will come forward that has that wee bit of information. Because it was the final bit of information that actually led to Brenton getting found.
We're just leaving the village of Glenavy now and heading out the Achillea Road towards St. Joseph's Chapel. Just that's the old railway bridge there. And so I used to walk this route sometimes to school. Most time we got lifts, but occasionally we had to walk it. Didn't think twice about walking these distances at that time. Sometimes you used to take shortcuts through the fields. I mean, think of it now, like 7 and 8 year olds taking shortcuts across the country. You'd be calling the police if you'd done that now. Wee river used to be here, used to fish for spricks again on the way home. Now we're coming up Chapel Hill, and just before you come to the top is the entrance to the graveyard. This is St. Joseph's Chapel. It's always lovely here, well kept. Okay, we've just arrived at the graveyard now, and we're walking over to the grave. It's a beautiful day, you can see down towards the lock. When I come back to the grave now, it was always sad, it still is sad, but when you'd come here, you'd be thinking of Brenton and where he was, you know. So, a certain relief now. It's not easy, but it's better than it was. Just looking at the headstone now, it's got Robert Joseph McGraw, who died 6th of August 1963, and his sons Gerald and Joseph, who died in infancy, and also his wife, her loving mother Bridget Nee Russell, who died 8th of January 2002. And then it says, and their son Brendan, born the 20th of May 1955 and disappeared the 8th of April 1978, and we intend to add that very shortly. Recovered from Orristown Bog, 2014. Laid to rest here, November the 14th. And the final words on the headstone are, we miss you all. Like, it's always sad when you come up to a grave, but it's nothing like what it used to be. Because you used to come here and you'd read those words and you'd be thinking how long we're going to have to wait before he's recovered. So at least, like, you know, it's, now we're like anybody else coming to the graveyard, you know. You know the names on the headstone, the bodies are all there. Like, we had a headstone and we didn't have the name of one of those people. One of the bodies wasn't here, so we've completed that part of it. And like, Mum remarried, but like, her instruction was to be buried here, and she always hoped. Well, she had hoped it should have Brenton buried before her, but. Certainly, like, we wanted to make sure that after she died that Brent was brought here and he's laid to rest with her. So from that point of view, like, it's satisfaction. It's still sad, you can probably hear my voice, but it's a lot better than what it used to be. When you used to leave here, it'd be very sad. So, like, we know, and his daughter's been here, and it's just a sense of completion. And it's a much nicer place than Orristown Bog ever was.
The McGraw family, while enduring 36 years of heartache and uncertainty, received some closure when Brendan's remains were located. Sadly, for some of the other families of the disappeared, the search continues. There are people who have yet to come forward with information that could lead to the recovery of the remains of those individuals who are still missing. If you have any information that can help in the search to locate the remaining disappeared, please call the Commission's confidential free phone line on 00800 555 8500.
This documentary was researched and produced by Ailey Sheehy with thanks to the McGraw family and the Independent Commission for the Location of Victims' Remains.